On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, ready?
Think what you know, and it's about a time when you get yourself in a wheel. I wanna know some of the things she's done. I'll think about everyone you need. I'm holding it, things are losing real now. I have you seen you wanting you. Hey.
Interracial. Okay, though. Interracial. Okay, though.
That might be the best question I've ever been asked.
What are the keys to being a great actor?
I believe listening.
To your scene partner, to your character?
Just listening. Listening is a really good quality, I believe. Always being in the moment by listening. Pay attention. They say, you know, no two takes are exactly the same. And you should be listening as if that were true. You should be listening as if this is the first time you're hearing it, every take.
Michael K. Williams, one of the great actors of our time, came by my studio in 2018 to talk about his documentary about criminal justice reform, Raised in the System, where he talks about some of the prison reform that we need and his nephew, Dominic, who was incarcerated for over 20 years. It's heavy to share this with you now after Michael has passed, but he was so passionate and so intense when talking about one of his most important subjects in the world, criminal justice and prison reform, that I wanted to share this with you so you could see the importance that those issues had to him in his life. I saw him at meetings and rallies and all kinds of things, trying to use his platform and his fame to increase the conversation about criminal justice reform. It was incredibly important to him, and that comes through in this interview. It's the late, great Michael K. Williams on Touré Show. Michael, you have put together a really, really powerful film about criminal justice system and some of the problems with it. And it's deeply personal for you.
Yes, sir.
Partly because Dominic, who's here. Yeah. Partly because of Jimmy Roseman.
Yes, sir.
But also because of your own personal journey.
Right.
What happened to you within the criminal justice system?
You know, my journey is from I was a boy, I've been visiting prisons since I started making visits to friends and family members since I was 16 years old. From Rikers on, you name it. Been to, most of the prisons up north, visiting family, mostly family members, but a few friends as well. So, you know, it wasn't until a mentor of mine, Michael Skolnick, we were at a meeting and he said, Mike, those closest to the problem are usually the ones closest to the solution. And that kind of made a light bulb go off in my head. Like, Mike, you may not have, thank God, because I don't know if I would have survived that environment, but I've been affected, and I've watched and I've seen the patterns and the things in which happen in one's life and how they end up in the system with what the mistakes were. I was in the community. It was parallel right there, seeing it go down. And, my journey was I went through it with them, because I've been visiting. I'm not going to leave my family in there unattended. So, that was my journey. And that pretty much what brought me to my understanding is it's like I got to get this rear view, this kind of a window where I see, okay, as a man now today, I see where the traps were laid and the parallels in all of my friends' stories, my family story. They all did the crimes at a certain age. It was just some similarities there, and then all of that kind of came to reality in the shape of this doc.
Man, what do people need to know about what's going on? Because we know a lot of people are going inside. We know that we have a larger prison population in this country than any other nation in the world by far. People who are on your side but don't have all the facts, what did they need to know?
Well, what I would hope, number one, is that, you know, because I wasn't even aware of the term school to prison pipeline. Mm. So, you know, there are some, I guess you call, for lack of a better word, basic facts that we're dealing with here. So, you know, privatizing prisons is a business. This is a fact. There are privately owned prisons in this country, right? And, you know,
It's crazy that we let people profit from incarcerating others.
Yeah, but let's look at it as real estate, right? So this, you know, some keep it, you know. So, you know, when you build, it's like a real estate in New York, a realtor in New York. So when you build a building, you want to fill those apartments, right? So it's pretty much the same thing with the prisons I've come to believe, right? And so what's happening is these prisons are being filled with, you know, people of color. Mostly, and also, you know, poor people. You know, we're setting up, we are the largest amount of young people locked up in the world. Like juvenile arrest right now, we are leading in the world. That's not a coincidence. That's not by chance. That's because they're filling the real estate with. Those cells are being filled with our youth. So I speak to that is the first direct fact that I speak to this. I hope that you can, when people watch this doc, they will learn that we're losing a generation of young people. You know, so now my quest is, if we're locking up our young people at that alarming number, the fact that the possibility that we are locking up our next leaders, our next business people, these kids are not stupid. Some of them have been traumatized. They never had a chance to be an adolescent, and they fall prey to the traps, and it's literally, this is a whole mechanism that goes into this, what they call this school to prison pipeline. And I would hope that anybody like myself, I was a little ignorant to that term before this doc came into my life. Mm-hmm. And now I have a full understanding of what that is and how that's being done. As my brother, Mr. Kaepernick, said, it's systemic. You know, it's like we're literally housing, it's, you know, prison is big business, and we're housing, you know, we're through this system right now, we are creating professional prisoners with the school to prison pipeline. And I just wanted to speak to that.
When you were a kid, were you at risk of falling into that, of getting arrested, getting into the system?
Absolutely. You know, my journey was drug addiction, right? You know, I started using drugs at a very young age.
What'd you start with?
Well, my same typical thing, pot, you know what I'm saying, and then drinking, and it started on a weekend thing. And, you know, with my insecurities and my issues as being a black man growing up in a dark skinned black man coming up in that time, it was difficult. It was a self-love thing, basically. But
you didn't love yourself
enough. No, not at all. That basically was definitely it. Did not feel valuable.
Nobody in the community was telling you you mattered?
I guess I just didn't hear it or wasn't looking for it. You know, at the end of the day, you know, somebody could tell you that all you want, but it's, if you don't believe it, if you don't feel it, but you know, when you got an oppressed community, It's not about people trying to lift you, everybody trying to, you know, lift themselves up. It wasn't a, you know, that type of environment growing up in the hood where people like, oh, you know, you could do it. You could do it. Like,
hell, I mean,
you got it. It was a, you know what I mean? It wasn't a, you know, I think that ability for brothers to communicate to and offer that type of language wasn't really going on.
I mean, you're right on the core of the issue. You know, I mean, Johann Hari wrote this incredible book about drugs, the drug war, called Chasing the Scream. And he talks about, they see that it's if you have a void in your life, that is a predictor of if you're going to abuse drugs, not use drugs, because a lot of people use drugs in a very responsible way, but abuse drugs, right?
Yes.
If you have too many negative childhood experiences to where you have voids in your life, then you're going to fall into abusing drugs. And that's
you're likely to, you know, yeah. what I'm saying? Because, you know, not everyone.
No, it's not 100%.
It's not 100%. But you know,
when
that
you talk about, I had a drug problem and I had a lack of love and a lack of self-esteem
let me be clear, you don't really, you know, it's something that, you know, I constantly now, when I say, you know, when you speak about it as had, it's something that I have to constantly be aware of. It never really, you know, if I start, you know, feeling negative about myself, it will still, that can still come into play, you know? And so I find that same issue plays out, at least in my community, on a lot of different ways. Like when you look at the gun violence, for instance, you know, in our community, right? It you know, out of all the things that are killing our young people in the community, the number one, what I've come to believe, is black-on-black gun violence, you know, one-on-one gun violence. We're killing each other at a larger number than anything else, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, a lot of that is done with, you know, illegal firearms. Like, you know, there's something, it's to the point where, you know, they're calling it like, we have to, like in Chicago, for instance, in the case of Chicago, they were like, I heard people saying that you have to look at it like a disease when that amount of you know, when it's that easy for one who looks like me to go up and kill someone who has my features and has my skin tone and that comes from my community, what is it that makes me, you know, so numb and feel like this is my only way out? You know, that's what I want to speak to. I want to speak to that. I want to go out. My goal is, you know, these children are some of the young people that you're going to see in this doc. You know, some of them have committed, you know, gun offenses or most likely are about to or in that world. You know, I just feel with the amount of numbers that we are losing our young people to the street with just the gun violence, I feel that, you know, we need to speak to that. And speak to that, and I'm not looking for, you know, and I think it's time that we need to find ways of healing our community ourselves, you know, which is like something in this doc that you're going to see, which is these brothers out there in Richmond, California, that started the program ONS, you know, I'm not going to talk too much on that. I want to save it for when the doc releases.
Okay,
but man, this is grassroots. You know, these are men who have been on that side of the tracks, you know, with literally gun charges in their past, and they are taking that to the community and making a difference in young men's life who are in the same vein of either doing the same thing or have already done the same thing what they did, and it's working. It's working, you know, so that's it. You know, this doc is about, let's find ways to heal our community. Let's find, because it's got to start with us now. It's I'm not looking for anybody. I'm just like, what can I do? You know, and how do we stop our young people from hurting? Right? Because I know what that feels like growing up hurting and just feeling, you know, and I took my anger and frustration and I turned it inward, right? But it comes from the same source.
And when you were on that road, use crack.
Yeah, you know, I smoked crack. I sniffed coke. You know what I'm saying? That was, cocaine was basically my downfall. But it was the 80s. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I definitely have, you know, a free base or sniff or smoke crack, whatever you want to call it.
I mean, how did you, I mean, it seems like, to me, like there's a psychological barrier. Like, you know, it's one thing socially to like smoke some weed. Like when you go to crack or freebasing, it's like.
Well, you got
to
understand, right? I come from an era where, you know, there were no crackheads running around when I was young. You know, I was probably in the city hanging out in a slightly adult environment that I should have been in, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, and I saw, you know, people, I saw it like it was done openly. Like, you know, people freebase their little private pipes on the dance floor. It was a different, it was introduced to me as classy or as elite as sniffing coke was, you know. And it wasn't like, you know, I didn't see people. My generation was the first one that you saw, like, you know, in New Jack City, you know, with Chris Rock's character. That was the first time that I'd seen that. And that was in my generation. That was when I was going through it. It was like, oh shit, that's me, you know, basically. But there was nothing before that that showed me that this can be, you know, cocaine and all that shit was presented to me as something classy and cool to do.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Back in 2018, Trump's Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported the parents back to their home countries, while keeping the kids in the United States, separating and destroying hundreds of families. It was heartbreaking. And years later, hundreds of families still have not been reunified. I recently learned about an organization that's trying to make a difference. It's El Atrolado, and it works to reunify families, providing holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in America and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. They've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once they're reunited, they help each family find legal representation, housing, counseling, whatever they need to get on their feet. Imagine having your child ripped from your arms just because you went to another country seeking a better life, and you never know when or if you'll ever see them again, and not ever seeing them again. We can't let family separations go on. It's inhumane. And if you're like me, and you believe that families belong together and immigration should not separate them, then join me in supporting El Atrolado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to El Atrolado in the description of this episode, or go to gun.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved: fill out an application at their website, elatrolado.org, volunteer. El Atrolado, ELOTROLADO.org/volunteer.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
When you were doing Omar on The Wire, you were also using with the local junkies.
Hanging out, I hung out in the streets for sure when I was shooting The Wire. I definitely hung out in the streets, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't wilding, but I was definitely, you know, doing some character research. Definitely doing some character
research. Was it really character research, or was it really
I thought it was at the time. Don't know if I would do that today. You know what I mean? I was young and stupid. But
how'd you get into acting?
Honestly, Torre, it was through the music video world. You know, it was that was the first time that I started really learning how to, I guess you would say, emote. And I got real blessed and found the off-Broadway community in New York City, like from La Mama Theater with Ellen Stewart to Tunde Samuels up there at National Black Theater. Uh-huh. And then when Mel Williams, his brother from Philadelphia, came into New York and he started a company called Theater for the New Generation. When I got with his classes and, you know, under his tutelage, things really started to mold for me. And it was shortly thereafter, I started going on auditions. And
what do you love about it?
I love the journey that character, that, you know, creating character takes me on. You know, it's somewhat of a time travel for me. You know what I mean? It's not just, for me, you know, yeah, where I go with it, with, you know, the way I create character and you know, build layers, and the parallels that, you know, I see where it's like these, I take these journeys with these characters, and then I, you know, they make me look at where my life is at the time when I'm playing these characters. So I see similarities. I get to have these little, you know, maybe I take things away from it, maybe leave things there, you know. And because when you're exploring characters, you know, you have to, that's another being you're creating, another set of life, you know, experiences that you're living in, and you're breathing life into that. So for me, it kind of makes, it's a natural reaction to compare your life to this character's life. So, you know, you take this journey, you know what I mean? And
what are the keys to being a great actor?
I believe listening. Listening.
To your scene partner, to your character.
Everything. Just listening. Listening. Listening is a really good quality, I believe. Always being in the moment by listening. Paying attention. Listening.
So does that mean that each scene or each take, rather, that each take is a little different because you are listening and reacting?
That's the goal. You know, sometimes, they say, you know, no two takes are exactly the same. And you should be listening as if that were true. You should be listening as if this is the first time you're hearing it, every take.
Can we talk about the night of?
Okay.
I mean, because this really...
I got you.
I mean, this builds off of what you've been living with.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you take the experience that you had throughout your life that all works as research and build that into this amazingly powerful, evil jail sort of... What would you call him? A jail, like sort of running the house?
I would just call him a human being. He was a dude in prison. That's what I would call him. But... you know, he again, which goes back to what I said earlier about at the rate that we lock people up in this country, it is, you know, it's very possible for me to believe that, you know, we have a lot of good people, a lot of strong-minded people who've made some bad mistakes behind those bars that, deserve a second chance at doing something and making a mark in society and having an impact on our community, because they've been there and now they can use their skills for good. So, you know, we take Freddie, for instance, and I went in with that for him, right? Okay. You know, I look at Dominic, right? You know what I'm saying? So when this man made his mistake, he was in college. There were no drugs. There was no weed. You know, come from, he wasn't like, you know, he was very focused. He was very, very focused and very determined, working young man, you know, always there around the family. Me and my nephew, always. We had a move, go to the movie, had a little movie night. Me and them kids would go to the movies, right? So it took one wrong mistake, because in our community, right, at this point, you know, it was like, you know, we were told, you have to take care of your family. You know what I mean? You have to, any mean necessary, you have to take care of your family. It was Vanderveer, who didn't have a gun in the house. I mean, that's the community we lived in, you know? And he, you know, fell prey to all we knew. You know what I'm saying? You see your brother being attacked. You know, boom, he went 0-60. There was
Dominic, you're...
Yeah, my nephew, that's what happened. He was defending his twin brother.
Was being attacked.
Yes, and he went out there with the illegal firearm, and he went to just with the notion just to say, you know, get off my brother, and, you know, get his brother out of the situation. And, you know, it got engulfed. The situation got very heated very quickly, and the gun went off, and unfortunately someone lost their lives. But it wasn't, you know, like... He was a gun, you know, gun-toting dude on the corner. It wasn't that situation. You know where I'm coming from? So here we have a young brother who had obviously, as you will see, has a lot of potential, you know, but one wrong mistake based on a bad decision it could change your whole life. So how many more people, men and women, are in our system who've just made a bad mistake. Good people who've made bad mistake. Regular people who made bad mistake. You know, so that's what I went in with for the night of. You know, and you know, yeah, there were issues. He had his drug issues in there. You know, that was his downfall, you know. He used his, you know, the difference between Dominic and Freddie, I say, is Fred used his special powers for, you know, he had ulterior motives, mm-hmm. You know, basically, mm-hmm. It was a little manipulative with his situation at times, you know, but it was always in a weird way. Always, you know, inclusive. He always included his, you know, people we cared about, and particularly Riz. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was a very odd world to be in.
It's interesting because we just had Taraji on the show, and mm-hmm. She talked about having empathy for your characters, and clearly you're talking about having a tremendous amount of empathy for Freddie, and that allows you to play him with much more depth.
Well, going back, thank you. And I take that as a compliment. And I think that going back to the start of our conversation is my childhood. Again, I saw how, you know, my people who I loved and played stickball with at one point in their life, you know, made some bad choices and ended up in a series of situations, and didn't mean I loved them any less.
Sure.
And you know, so I got to watch. It's really odd. And so, you know, I come into all my characters with that already built in. It's innate because I know these people in some odd way, and which is again how I spoke to my characters. They kind of, as I look back and I'm like, there's always these like odd little parallels between my real life and these characters that actually have chosen me. You know,
the characters are choosing you.
I don't, you know, I would like, I mean, I'm just trying to stay, keep it popping, keep it moving and stay working and stay paying my bills, man. You know, so a lot of times, you know, especially in the early days, man, you know, HBO, bro, that was what an environment to grow up in and to be able to home in on my craft. What a platform HBO has given me over the past 15 years. Because you got to remember, man, it's The Wire, there's Lackawanna Blues, there's Bessie, there's Boardwalk Empire, there's The Night Of, you know, HBO has given me a lot of burn time. A lot of burn time, a lot of opportunity to home in and get it right. And then, you know, come on, man, you go from, and just in those few names, I went from George Wolfe to Steven Zaillian to Terry Winter to David Simon to George, did I say George Wolfe? George motherfucking Wolfe?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that mm-hmm. I worked with all of those icon, excuse me, forgive me, may I forget Martin Scorsese?
Mm.
This is all within my 15 years at HBO. So I had a lot of opportunity I'm not even going to get into the talent that I was blessed to be around in that. So, you know, I always say, man, and I was basically raised by wolves being over there at HBO. And, you know, I got to tell really great stories early on in my career. I was blessed with the opportunity of you know, being around great talent and being given the opportunity to tell great stories through amazing writing. That's such a blessing. It was like, I mean, you can't, I would never trade that. And as I'm taking this journey, it wasn't like, you know, I was pan picking these characters. I was too busy growing the fuck up.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? And seeing these parallels that were beginning to happen and like, oh shit, you know, it was something else going on. And, you know, so this documentary is a kind of a collection of a lot of that shit,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that. You know, it's not a coincidence. It's not random that Dominic is coming home. Like, you know, this documentary, when we first see him, he's incarcerated.
Mm. Did you know he was coming home when you were
no.
making, started making the
No.
So that was a surprise to you?
Oh.
Wow.
You see what I'm trying to tell you?
Because you've been talking about Dominic for as long as I've known you.
And
always talking about Dominic.
Yes, sir.
And I'm watching the doc. I had no idea that he was going to come home in the doc, which gives it this light moment in the midst. Because it's heavy. At one point in the doc, you cry.
Yeah, man. Michael, man, that kid in Newark. Well, first of all, I'm talking to a little dark-skinned young man, this handsome, dark-skinned young, this little boy with a scar on his face named Michael. And he starts to talk about, like, how he's just having a tough time in life. And I'm looking at him, and I'm just like, do you know how powerful you are and how beautiful you are? And I'm just like, and then he starts talking, and when he says that, when I ask him what does he want to be, and he tells me that he wants to use his pain and what he's been through in life at, was like 11 years old, and he wants to use that as a teaching tool for kids that are going through the system like him, so he could show them that it's just a wall you have to break through and you can do it. Bro, It was surreal, to say the least, and not random. You know what I'm saying?
I think a lot of folks may not really realize that in most situations, prison makes it worse. Whatever you have going on in your life, prison's going to make it worse. And one of the things you point out in the doc as well that I appreciate the age at which most crimes are committed is about 15 to 20.
Yeah.
By 25, most people do not commit basic street crimes.
But see, but Tory,
but we continue to incarcerate them after they are an actual danger to society.
Well, that's the problem, right? And then the other problem is, you know, we're forgetting that, okay, these kids are adolescents, right? And adolescents do adolescent behavior. Mm. Adolescent behavior is a scientific word or term for dumb shit.
But they are not developed.
No, they're not, right? But okay, so some of these kids are doing some shit out there.
There are scientific ways in which impulse control is not set.
This is again scientific, facts, yeah. Right? I ain't saying what I heard. This is facts, right? So and we are, in a sense, criminalizing adolescent behavior. Now, I'm not saying that our young people should not be made to pay for mistakes when they cross criminal lines. What I am saying is, what you said to speak to what you just said a few seconds ago, especially when you're dealing with minors, man, there needs to be a different type of setting when we send kids to pay for mistakes. We need to create facilities, number one, that are smaller. Number one, that cater to the 9 times out of 10 trauma that he or she may be going through, right? Because you can't forget that these kids are already adolescent. They've been traumatized, whether sexual, physical, you know, lack of this, lack of that. Mm. And then you add that on top of adolescent behavior. And what do? We lock them up in an adult-like prison situation.
Away from family, away from support system.
And then when we release them back into the community, they have nothing to lean on, right?
Can't go to public housing.
No, nothing.
It's hard to get a job.
Bro, fuck that. The damage internally. Are you kidding me? You know how much unpacking it
would. And their connection to people who are criminal or have done deviant things is stronger.
It's a trap. Yeah. So, you know.
To say nothing of when they are traumatized in prison by rape or just the general incarceration experience.
It goes on and on and on. I want to just stay in the light because we can go on and on. We know what's out there, right? Yeah. I'm agreeing with you.
Oh, no, but we got to talk about it, right? We got to let people know.
Yeah. I mean, you got to be under what fucking rock to know that, to not know that, you know, kids are out there suffering. I didn't know there was a school to prison pipeline, but, you know, I knew that, you know, the youth was in trouble.
Yeah.
My kids in trouble. Our next generation is in trouble right now and they're hurting. You know, you got to be deaf, dumb, and stupid to not see that, right? We need smaller facilities, right? And we need facilities with programs that it don't take a lot of money. Programs it's to help them to grow. We cannot forget the fact that these are still malleable minds, even though they made a mistake.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin,
She introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
Now, I'm not talking about, you know, the mental illness that would lead to doing something extremely, you know, I don't know what that world looks like. I'm talking about kids who have just made mistakes and find themselves in a really retarded situation due to peer pressure or lack of social skills.
Because Dominic is here. Dominic, you were inside for how long?
20 years, 7 months, 18 days.
What can be done, what should be done to make being in prison and doing your time more effective for society and for the prisoners so that you're not doing the time and being turned into an even worse member of society?
Thank you. That's a great question, Tori. So I think the first thing that we should do is take a look at some of the programming that's offered in the correctional facilities. One of the things that I've often believed is that good programming is good security inside the prison. And as we start to prepare men and women who are incarcerated in New York State to transition back into the community, I think it starts there. It can't be surface stuff. It can't be things where the men and women are forced to be engaged and be involved in things that their heart is not really in. We have to take a look at some of the real challenges, some of the real hurdles that are going on in our communities, in the prisons. Take a look at those things, as ugly as they may be, address those issues, take a look at values, take a look at integrity, take a look at some of the things that it would take for people to be successful. I really think that it starts there. Where it will go, it will take much longer than we have to talk about.
Did the prison give you any tools that would help keep you from going back?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, my environment was something that I had to take a look at and assess, you know, whether I was going to be that negative person or whether I was going to be the person who took a look at my situation and said, I am not going to be defined by that one worst moment in my life. I will not allow my geographical location to define me. I will not let labels define me. This concept about convict and you prisoner and that, you know, I'm less than a human being because of that one bad decision that I made in my life was something that I was going to rebel against.
But that's something that you thought of for yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Did the prison itself give you any tools that would help keep you from going back? Or is it set up so maybe he will come back?
Well, you know what? I think that we can make our own personal choices. I think to answer specifically your question, I think everything starts with us.
Yeah.
If you're not here, then what are you here for? So absolutely, it started with me. Were there programs that helped cultivate that concept? Absolutely. I worked with a few of them. One was called the Alternative to Violence Project. Another one was called the Exodus Transitional Community Program, which is a community-based program. You know, it has several places, one in Harlem, one in Poughkeepsie, one in Newburgh. They're currently looking at opening another place in Albany because the rates of incarceration are going up there. And then we also have other service providers in New York State and New York City that assist with these services. Some are called Fortune Society, and there are a few other ones. I think, for me, that those agencies that we connected with, specifically Exodus Transitional Community, provided a bigger platform for men to understand that they can be better, but they have to work hard. And using the excuse that you're in prison to not become a better person, like Dr. Muhammad said, is lame. That's just the bottom line. And we have to be actively involved in that process. That means that no matter what challenges you're faced with, no matter what person you come in contact with, whether it's one of your peers or whether it's a staff member who may be having a bad day, you cannot use that as a crutch. You cannot use that as a reason to say, you know what, I'm not going to do better. I am going to, you know, just go with the regular status quo and believe all the hype that you see on some of these prison TV shows, Lockdown and all these other things where they show nothing positive about the people in prison. If that is true, then our society is in a very, very dark place. And we need to question where our tax dollars are going. We need to question why are we housing people in warehouses where we have more people in prison than we do in college. It's unacceptable to me.
I want to talk to you more about acting.
Yeah.
What'd you learn from Scorsese?
Wow. I learned the power of silence. You know, the way he runs his set, there's a calmness and a quietness that you come that I've always look for in other sets, and you don't. There's always some sort of a clamor and chat. I mean, you know, like it's, yeah. That was the main thing I learned: the power of silence and what the silence that creates such an intense. He's a for the actor. Like when the set is completely silent, what that does for the actor is amazing. It's amazing.
What advice do you have for younger Black actors coming up?
Tell your story. And I tell that for all young thespians coming up of all races. Tell your story. Write your story. Do not come into this business, young people like me, you know, waiting for the Hollywood to, you know, to give me my opportunity or, you know, hoping that I was good enough. Come in good enough. Know that you are good enough. Write your story. And do you. Be you. Do not conform. Be you. Be you, because that's the best outfit, the best character, you know, that comes through in this business is when it's honest and pure.
Thank you so much to Michael for a great interview. You will never be forgotten.